This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome back to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined by John Bryce of Irish Illustrated and FootballScoop.com and Pete Sampson from The Athletic. And we are, as Pete just was reminded, about a week away from starting spring ball. Every once in a while, we all lose a week of life in our lives, Pete. That happened to me recently. But yeah, 1 week away from the first spring practice, and then a couple weeks thereafter until we have access again and they reconvene. So that's actually been something Brian Kelly introduced probably a decade ago, right, guys? That get one practice in, you can review all that, and you have a little bit of extra time for your spring. It's manufacturing more time in spring ball.
Yeah, on the day that we officially have an extra day to the shortest month of the year, Pete realizes he's lost a week somehow. So there's a great serendipity there. No, it's an exciting time. There are a number of exciting newcomers on campus, as well as guys we're waiting to see what kind of steps forward they take. We won't see, obviously, very much at all next Thursday, but I believe we do see the entire practice. So it'll be good just to see some of the early results of the offseason program and just sort of the way things are trending.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the 4-year anniversary of Kevin Austin Day next week. And then to see, you know, the early enrollees, we all sort of fixate on like, okay, who looks like they fit in physically, who doesn't. There are always guys in both parties. Are there any other sort of off-season cleanup injuries that might stop a guy from participating? That's part of it. And then with the grad transfers being what they are now, they're sort of like early enrollees. You want to see how they fit in. You know, I think we have eyeballs, and we were with RJ Open and Riley Leonard a couple weeks ago. I think that they will fit in just fine. The other ones I am curious about, though, you know, where Jordan Clark fits into the secondary, you know, how they come out there with those kind of reps, who's helping Mike Mickens in the secondary, you know, from a coaching point of view. So it's a good reintroduction to everything. But I mean, I think John sort of alluded to this. It's not something that needs to be taken with biblical proportions in terms of what it means long term.
No, we have one of those, though. We do have one of those on April 13th.
There, yeah, that's going to be
the best open practice we will have seen in several years, at least back to 2018, where they accidentally put a net out there for Pete and I to watch. Everything went haywire after that. But and two new arms to watch, though, next Thursday. I think that's fun because it was intrigued to watch Sam Hartman. But when you throw a little CJ Carr on top of Riley Leonard, that makes it fun for especially when you're not getting hit at all. And there's nobody hitting. So those two arms are something to kind of compare to Angeli and Minchie. And, you know, Marcus Freeman wants four quarterbacks. I hate to be the lead balloon guy. He wants four quarterbacks for the spring. Four quarterbacks are unlikely in the fall, and this is something for us to watch those quarterbacks starting out.
Yeah, and I will say just quickly, I know we've had some people asking on the board about early buzz or anything like that, so I tried to ask around, get a little bit of intel over the past week, and I will say apparently the speed of Jaden Harrison has been quite obvious, quite eye-catching in some of the football school stuff and some of the other basically OTAs that Notre Dame has been executing over the past several weeks. So I'm excited to see that. There's been understandably some optimism about the younger linebackers. Specifically, Kingston has already flashed some, and Peyton Bowen taking that next step. They've said the same about Snead and Osberry. And then Bryce Young has flashed a little bit, just physically very raw. So those are some of the things I'm looking forward to.
Breaking news there. Peyton Bowen has flashed in the offseason. Yeah. Or Drake Bowen.
Yes.
Drake. So sorry.
Yeah. I did that like a month ago on the podcast.
I looked up and wondered why you clowns were laughing. Yeah. You should have just cut my fool self off. It would have been just fun.
No,
he's one of those trigger words for us.
That's bad because somebody brought that recruitment up to me yet again this week. And so in the process of some of the scouting. So anyway, I'm a fool.
Yeah, it's, I don't unfortunately, you maybe guys can correct me if I'm wrong. They're like, we're not going to see Bo Collins or
Hurd
out there, or Rod Hurd there. So that, I mean, that would have been interesting to sort of see how they fit into the mix a little bit. Hurd in particular, because I think that he's got a chance to start next to Xavier Watts. I don't think we'll see this Thursday, but in that open scrimmage, where's Jalen Seed lining up? What are they doing with him? He's probably, I don't want to say he's the most intriguing guy on the roster to me, but he's way up there. And not because I think he's going to start or get 50 snaps a game. Just like, how do you take advantage of that? So that will be interesting to watch. I think Thursday, it's all about newcomers. There are a ton of newcomers, both early enrollees and grad transfers. So that's kind of what I'm going to be all over.
Yeah, and even as he's recovered from his ankle procedure, I've been told that Riley Leonard just has a really easy, already established demeanor with his teammates, and so I'll be curious to sort of watch some of those dynamics. But he's been praised as just sort of this everyman that's found his way into already kind of knitting together some camaraderie with the team. And then the Clark kid, they said, has just shown some really good football intelligence and maturity. So I know he didn't have the most voluminous film coming from Arizona State, but those are just a few of the tidbits picked up along the last week. And guys, because of that I'll pay extra close attention to next Thursday.
Two great interviews too, Riley Leonard and Jordan Clark. Those two were fantastic to talk to. Two new guys, not really, but we're going to pretend they're new because they were introduced to us as new. Mike Denbrock, the least new guy that's ever come to Notre Dame. We talked to Mike Denbrock last Friday for the first time since hiring. And also Max Bulla. I have managed not to say Chuck, and I'm hoping I can continue not to say Chuck, but we got to talk to Max Bulla, who was a joy to talk to because, as he pointed out, I was a linebackers coach last year, and he was very adamant about that. I think, it's not that surprising that Al Golden was able to delegate to him and why he was such an easy hire, John.
Yeah, an easy hire, a smart hire, a good one to retain. Obviously the Chris O'Leary model was the predecessor, but he really grew, I think, since Marcus got here in 21. We saw O'Leary elevate his skill set as a coach to new levels, and Max Bulla has done that across the last year from working with Marcus and with Al, and already had some familiarity with some other guys on the team. And again, he was absolutely going to be hired by Boston College, likely into a co-defensive coordinator role. I think that's a win for Notre Dame. And then his passion, as Pete and I really visited at length with him, stood out to me. And I thought Pete had some really good questions in that setting. And it was fun getting to talk to Max and hear that.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's a football guy. And that, like, just comes through in what he says and how he says it. Just the way he's put together. He's kind of one of those guys. I think we joked in the past of since you referenced the 2018 net practice, like, who's that scout team quarterback? He's really got a nice. Oh, it's Reese. Like, I think if Bulla just hopped into a practice with the linebackers, you'd be like, oh man, is this a new guy? Did they add a transfer that we don't know about? He's just really impressive. And I think that he strikes me as somebody who will be a natural, both in terms of relating to the kid who is on profile for Notre Dame and the kid who's off profile for Notre Dame. And that's like not always easy to do. So I think that's, he's got a great setup here in terms of learning from both Al Golden and Marcus Freeman. It wasn't an apprenticeship like it was at Alabama, which you referenced, which I also thought was amazing. I'm a big fan of Max Bulla. I know talking to players and sort of their families were impressed with him a year ago when he was sort of the incoming guy. But I think he has earned that job over the course of the last 12 months, and there's a lot of people that are happy that he got it.
I can't do this quote justice, but when he said, I'm good with computers, but where I belong is down there, was one of my favorite things I've heard. Just to hear a coach say, I'm good with computers, and point behind him to the Goog, and then point to the fields that are down there.
I immediately thought of Office Space and, like, I'm a people person. Like, what would you say you do here? Like, I'm good with computers. Like, I just loved everything about Max Bulla. They could sub him in for Marcus Freeman on Monday during the seasons if he wants to come out and do his press conference.
We've had plenty of Mike Denbrock time, just not as recent as in the past. But I think The most interesting thing Denbrock said, and kudos to whoever listened to this question downstairs for the TV cameras, was when he went in depth saying, I think we'll be more 11 personnel than 12. I mean, that's maybe because we just know not to ask coordinators those questions in the spring, but it turns out you could go ahead and ask. I mean, this is not a panacea for all these things, you know, when you're going 11 personnel instead of 12 at Notre Dame. But I started writing in late season last year. It was probably after Clemson, I'm sure, because of what happened in the Clemson game. That the two tight end thing, the three tight end thing, the how cool four tight ends are when you're at the goal line and stuff works great against North Carolina and teams like that. It's tough to not be able to spread the field and run in short yardage situations or pass in short yardage situations with your athletes in space like the best teams do. Because if you put everybody in a box, Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, they have answers for it. Clemson, they have answers for it. I know there's exceptions to the rule, but I loved hearing that, and it should be fun to watch with the personnel they have coming up.
That was a Matt Freeman specialty, so shout out Matt Freeman.
Congrats,
for asking
Matt.
That question. Really savvy question by him, and yeah, some great insight there from Mike Denbrock, and I think that probably very much certainly excited people. And again, you have a veteran guy comfortable in his skin who is also very transparent about wanting to continue to grow and evolve and find all the possible ways to get better, and I think that's a winning recipe.
And I mean, to be fair, like if this roster was Rudolph, Eifert, yep. I would say you're insane for not, leaning into 12 personnel, but it's not, it's Mitchell Evans coming back from ACL. It's Eli Raerdon, who is scratching the surface. Cooper Flanagan, coming into his sophomore year. So I don't think that the personnel lends itself to what it did. Certainly when Reese was here, and they ran four tight ends, like that worked. Last year, I thought you saw a pretty noticeable drop off in the efficiency when they went into that set. But hopefully that for Notre Dame's sake, that means that they've got three or four receivers that justify going to 11 personnel. Because if it does, then this could be a much more exciting offense to watch.
I think it does. But I know what you're saying, Pete. Is it de facto going to 11 personnel because they have to? I do think the additions help that, though. Last year, they couldn't have done it.
Right. And then one quick tight end note is we still await to see, because he missed every game last year, Kevin Ballman. He is back, so there's still that other figure in the tight end room to just see where he is at in his recovery and what he might potentially be able to contribute down the road for this team.
Irish Illustrated Insider had a 45-minute conversation with Jack Swarbrick yesterday. I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that. I had a few takeaways. We have one or two questions on it as well. But I felt myself during it. We obviously had an outline and a plan and everything, but boy, I couldn't stop going back to NIL conversations because it feels like it just completely dominates everything we do, but not in the way where, oh, fans want to know this. It's literally, I want to know all these things as well. I feel like NIL just dominates conversations now in the modern college football interviews.
The last 2 weeks I've been out speaking to three alumni clubs, Phoenix, Sarasota, and Jacksonville. And I would say that 40% of the questions that I get are NIL. I've done a couple where it's been more than half. So it is the story of college sports right now. What's going on with the court system in Tennessee and Virginia, which I don't know if you guys got into this specifically with Jack. I don't think so. Essentially, inducements are allowed now, or they won't be stopped. So
they won't be stopped. Yeah.
Yeah. It, how Notre Dame has leaned into this more, I think, is more aggressive than maybe Jack wanted to get into, just my opinion. I think that Notre Dame is in a pretty healthy spot with it. I think the question that if I had written in a question for you, I would want to know, how does he feel about the op-ed that Father John wrote in 2015 in the New York Times? Because I feel like Notre Dame at the time was like, basically, we'll take our ball and go home. That's not how they've acted since, which is good. I think that they've gotten comfortable with the new order of college sports and figuring out a way to be aggressive and play this game, but play it in a more Notre Dame style way. So I thought it was interesting. And like, yeah, the NIL stuff, I thought your question about Marcus Burton and Hannah Hidalgo, like what happens when an unnamed Duke, Kansas basketball power comes from Marcus Burton. You know, I think Notre Dame women's basketball is a little bit more established than the men's program, but that's kind of an interesting dynamic as well.
NIL is the focus everywhere. It's especially since the court ruling, the injunction was issued last Thursday by a federal judge in Tennessee, basically halting the NCAA from enforcing any rules surrounding inducements and as it pertains to recruiting and labeling those as NIL opportunities, basically, or saying they can't be stopped because they're part of the negotiating process. So I've had more conversations than I can count about that over the across the past 8 days or so. And it was a really great question from you all for Jack, because Jack has been very active, along with a couple of other people from Notre Dame on Capitol Hill throughout all of this, trying to help get some sort of framework, trying to get some guardrails established. And we'll keep talking about it because that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to know that there's some sort of level playing field out there. But to Notre Dame's credit, they didn't stay overly stubborn about that 2 years ago when it took off more than 2 years ago. But 2 years ago is when it was pretty much just unleashed through the gates. And Notre Dame has responded very quickly across the past 2 years. I think that's part of the charisma of Marcus Freeman and the way that he's built meaningful relationships along the way and can work with other people on campus to help make some of this stuff happen. So, yeah, it probably has unfolded at a much quicker pace than what Jack has wanted. Notre Dame has worked to keep up to that. It is the next great frontier. That's what I've been, again, having conversations about. I was on the phone with a GM of a Power Four program last night for almost 45 minutes late last night, just trying to get educated on it. Pete, you made a great point about the inducements and basically they can't be legislated or stopped right now. He outlined it to me that there are two school of thoughts that, okay, some people are interpreting that injunction as saying, well, now that's not fair because Tennessee and the states of Tennessee and Virginia just to get to do whatever they want in recruiting because they're the ones who took the necessary legal steps. But he said the practical fact of the matter is everyone's going to do what they want now because nothing's going to stand up in court. There's no fear of reprisal with this injunction having already been issued. And so what you're going to see is it's now going to become de facto unofficial visits are going to become even more so official visits. You're going to have to pay for unofficial visits. I've already talked to a number of, again, coaches, football GMs, directors of player personnel. I've probably had about seven of those conversations in the last week, ranging from outgoing Pac-12 schools to multiple SEC to schools here in the Midwest. That's the big concern. Everybody wants to know how much money with this most recent court ruling and where things are going in NIL, how much money do we need for the next few months just to pay to get unofficial visitors on campus? So that's something significant. That was really good. Really good part of the interview from you guys with Jack.
I would encourage everybody to listen to that interview from yesterday. It can be found at our homepage, still or on our message board at Irish Illustrated. But Pete, I want to review your travel schedule for speaking engagements. I think those cities were better than, say, like Shelbyville, North Haverbrook, and Ogden or Starkville, right? You did a good job there.
Yeah, my requirement for speaking to a Notre Dame alumni clubs is, would I just visit here anyway? And yeah, that's
no North Platte, huh?
Nope. Florida and Arizona are welcome. Denver and Seattle, I'll see you this summer.
Oh, real quick, and one last thing on the hoops element of the NIL. And I tweeted this out this week, and some of you guys retweeted me to the Hannah Hidalgo point. There's no accident that Notre Dame has taken such a proactive stance, sending out or handing out some of those golden hoop earrings and launching a website dedicated just to Hannah Hidalgo's ACC freshman of the ACC player of the year, national freshman of the year campaign. That's not direct NIL, that's marketing, but trust me, that's sending a message to Hannah Hidalgo that, hey, we value you, we want to build around you. And she has been getting some significant NIL opportunities presented to her, or at least floated to her, and that's going to be a big part of it. I think it's only a matter of time, whether it's here or at a school, maybe it's at an Auburn in men's basketball because of the way Bruce Pearl recruits, that they have somebody who signs a deal with Nike, even though they're an Under Armour school. And then what happens? Does that student athlete have to tape up those shoes on game days, or what do? We already have some Notre Dame women's basketball players that have medical notes to wear Nike shoes. So it's just a real, really interesting element is what's coming next. And the shoe thing and the apparel thing, I think, is more prevalent on the basketball side of college athletics than it is on the football side.
We have a few combine questions we can handle in segment two, but just with it underway, I think the thing I really want to see I won't see Cam Hart's medicals. I won't know about Cam Hart's medicals until he gets drafted, I suppose. But how Cam Hart can perform at this and help his stock, assuming his medicals are okay, they can't be great. And I want to see J.D. Bertrand, after training for the 40, see what he runs. Remember, Drew Tranquil pulled out a 4.57 at this combine, and you know he trained every single day to run that 4.57. I get the feeling J.D. Bertrand knew to train every single day to run this 40-yard dash as well.
That will be an interesting one. I saw Gervonta Jean-Baptiste talk, sort of explain the All-Star game skip or the move, you know, where he had an illness that he overcame. But Bertrand, I think, you know, once and for all, putting Bertrand's speed to rest would be lovely at the NFL Combine. So I hope that happens. And he, you know, flies through the 40-yard dash, just so you can post it and pin it on your message board.
We'll be back with segment two, which will include the Hoops revival and almost an incredible comeback of all time involved in that one. Segment two coming up, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question goes back to the Swarbrick conversation in segment one. This is from N. Jacobs 3. How surprising was it to hear no movement on the Freeman extension talk? I think that's completely true, or maybe Swarbrick just wants the next AD to be able to get full credit.
I think there's probably a little bit of semantics involved there. I don't think in this day and age in college football, you don't have head coaches operating on four-year contract terms anymore, unless there's some underlying reason for that. And there's not, you know, Marcus Freeman remains incredibly popular. He took the program a step forward by producing his first 10-win season this past fall as head coach. They've continued to recruit at a very high level. It will be something that gets ultimately fully handled by Pete Bavakwa and the new leadership. Don't forget there's new presidential leadership coming in as well. So I think you look at those two things, that has far more to do with it than anything about Notre Dame and Marcus Freeman being at some sort of detente.
Yeah, I think that he has not earned a contract extension yet. And I thought that Swarbrick explained that quite clearly. After this year, you'll see you'll see where things are. This should be a year where Marcus Freeman earns that contract extension. And it probably, let's be clear, like, I think that he will earn the extension that he wants after this year. Whereas I think the one that he would be offered right now, you know, it's kind of a bet on yourself situation. And I think for Notre Dame's point of view, it's like, let's see what you got when you have this, you know, a very, very good coaching staff, a really good roster. Like, Notre Dame feels very all in on the season. If I was Marcus Freeman, I'd be like, all right, this is the season I would like to be judged on when it comes to a contract extension.
Next question is from Play Like a Champ 7. What are your thoughts on talks of college football expanding before we've even played one college football playoff with 12 teams? I thought of Pete when I read this one.
Oh God. The sport is a snake eating its own tail. I've said that a million times. It continues to do that. The idea of this 3-3-2-2-1 format where the Big Ten gets three automatic bids, the SEC gets three automatic bids, the ACC gets two automatic bids, the Big 12 gets two automatic bids, Group of Five gets one automatic bid is disgusting. But it is less disgusting than what the Big Ten and the SEC reportedly proposed, which essentially was a 4-4-2-2-1, where there was one at-large bid at the very end of it. If the college football playoff wants to reward mediocrity and build in revenue, guaranteed revenue for those leagues, which is what this whole thing is about, you know, congratulations on killing interest in this before it even gets started. It's disgusting to me. And that has nothing to do with like its impact on Notre Dame, which is bad. But just in terms of taking a playoff that rewards excellence during the regular season, and then just killing that off before you get started. Like, the conference championships games are in some ways as interesting, if not more interesting now in the 12-team playoff that's set up. 3-3-2-2-1, I mean, who cares at that point? I don't know. The whole thing is incredibly disappointing, but not surprising.
And I know it's not exactly the same, although there were some conferences already in hoops that have much larger rosters for their one automatic qualifying bid. But we saw last fall, we've seen pretty much every year of the CFP's final rankings, that on an expanded format, the Big Ten and the SEC would have been getting multiple teams in. There's not the need for the guarantee. The right. guarantee does nothing but kill interest in the playoffs almost before they get started in expanded form for sure. But then it further drives down interest in the regular season, which in then in turn is going to see ratings fall. And then you're going to have TV executives wanting to go back to the conference commissioners and the university leadership saying, well, we overpaid for these games because not as many people are watching now. Well, yeah, fools, not as many people are watching now because you want a bunch of participation trophies handed out before the season kicks off. That's foolish. That's absolutely foolish. Let it be earned on the field. That's supposed to be the merit of an expanded 12-team playoff, is that more teams have a shot by what they do over the course of the season, not that more teams have a shot because they start the year knowing we don't have to be one of the best in our conference. We just get to be top 25% in our conference and we can play for a national title.
The funniest, though, well, there's only one funny part about this, was on my Twitter feed, somebody thought Play Like a Champ, who asked this question, obviously sarcastically, because he has seen what's been going on behind the scenes. Someone, I guess, didn't know. And he's like, why would you want to change the playoffs? It's like, that's the point. We have to give it a shot right now. It's And John, driving home your point, I think this destroys November. Switching to that 3-3-2-2-1 format, or as Pete said, the 4-4 is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, and as Jack Swarbrick said yesterday, when you're trying to figure out how to make this season work with the playoffs now, and you're going to expand it more, there cannot be conference championship games. And why would Georgia or Alabama or anyone want to play a conference championship game that could knock you out of something?
Yeah, and the SEC is going to shift to a 9-game conference model in a couple of years anyway. They've not been satisfied with the negotiating process for a modified TV contract as a result of that. That's why they're band-aiding the 24 and 25 seasons with these still retaining the 8-game conference slate instead of the 9-game slate. So don't overlook the fact that there are a lot of negotiating tactics built into this, but nonetheless, it's stupid. Like, let it be earned on the field.
Tom, the intern, has an objective question we are going to answer subjectively. As part of my power rankings model, he's updated one that's home field advantage, which is determined by your home win-loss record and attendance over a 5-year period. He had Notre Dame comes out number 10 in his model, with mostly SEC and Big Ten teams ahead of them. And of course, Clemson is in there as well, as Notre Dame found out, at number 7. Do you guys think that's fair? Around 10, would you think Notre Dame has about the 10th best home field advantage now, higher or lower? And conveniently, right. Michigan was one, I would like to point out, because they also didn't lose at home as much.
Winning at home, your home field advantage is informed by how many games you win at home. I think Notre Dame, is around 10th, sounds about right. I wouldn't spend much time arguing about Notre Dame, whether they're 11th or 7th or 8th or 10th.
I think it's maybe... You got 2 bad losses in there in Marcus Freeman's first year at home, because he lost to Marshall and Stanford. That skews it a little bit. Otherwise, Notre Dame has been excellent at home. Should have won that game against Georgia in 2017. Had so many opportunities to have had complete control of that game. Settled for far too many field goals over the course of that contest. But they beat Michigan at home during that time. They've beaten Clemson two times at home, I think, during that run. Both times when Clemson was a top 5 team or a number 1 team. They've beaten an undefeated USC during that time. I don't think Notre Dame has this ultimate home field advantage that an LSU does, or Georgia or Alabama, particularly at night. Michigan plays, I think, about 1 tough home game a year.
That helps
too.
That's
always a midday game. They built a long time for that after losing a whole bunch of home games to Ohio State every other year in succession. So I think Notre Dame around 10 makes sense. I think Notre Dame has a really nice home field advantage. I think if they had more of these games, if they had a Georgia in November, what would that look like when the weather turns a little bit more and you can kind of capitalize on some of the things that Notre Dame very much hopes it gets to capitalize for as long as we have this 12-team playoff.
Interesting enough, on Tom's model, a team right in front of Notre Dame is Texas A&M. So we can go ahead and judge that next year. I think they have a little bit of a home field advantage when it's the opening game against Notre Dame, definitely at night in August 31st as well. That it kind of makes it more of a home field advantage than when you have to get up for Marshall and Stanford, or as Michigan seems to get up for everybody and beat them anyway. But yeah, that's home field advantage when you're rising to the occasion is kind of tough to put into a model, but that'll be one we get to see firsthand. This is from Irish Man 50, and I want to include it because Priester did give me his six choices, so we can do this one pretty quickly. I'm going to abbreviate his question, but what is the perfect road game schedule for each of the four of you? So we're going to pick six total road games, and one can go ahead and be neutral if you would like.
Go ahead.
And I got Priesters. I got Priesters.
Yeah, go with Priesters here, and first.
I'm sure there's some who can guess, but Priester wants to visit. His is based upon favorite cities and stadiums, nothing to do with the fact that you have to play all these teams or strength of schedule. Knoxville, Athens, Austin, Pittsburgh, which I had a feeling he would have in there, Pasadena, and I guess that would be the neutral one, and Colorado Springs.
I had a decent amount of overlap there. I sort of viewed it as like, you also like what the game I really want to cover is a playoff game. So I can't have Tuscaloosa, Athens, Baton Rouge in there. So I kept it a little bit more realistic. Colorado Springs was one of them because you get to go to Denver Air Force. You can win that game. I like one trip to the sort of research triangle schools per year in North Carolina. Yeah. And I would include like Wake Forest in there too. So any of those four teams would be fine. Arizona State is on there. Washington. Texas would be the marquee road game of a place I really wanted to go to. And then the greatest road trip of them all, Stanford, to close the season.
I would go with the University of Texas first. For me, that would be one. I've seen games in a lot of places. I've covered a game at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, so that's pretty awesome. I would love to do that again. Washington is a great one for me because I haven't covered it. It would be on my list. I imagine that I will be there this fall. That would be at USC. I've just not seen a game in the Coliseum, so I would like to do that. Penn State would be one. I think there's some natural history there between Notre Dame and Penn State, so I would very much like to do that. Been to Michigan, been to Ohio State. No, a Notre Dame night game at LSU, I think, would be really cool. I've covered a handful of games at LSU through the years. It's a pretty awesome experience. You don't ever want to do a day game in Baton Rouge. It's not the same. And then a bunch of the other ones. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's Texas. It's USC in the Coliseum. It's Washington for sure. I've been to Oregon. That one's really neat. It's Penn State for sure. Beyond that, I don't have a lot of strong feelings. This is a bunch of stadiums I've already been to. Those are probably the four main ones. And then, yeah, throw in a couple of playoff games in there. Texas is the overarching one for me, though, for sure.
Yeah, that's the Rose Bowl, Pasadena. I'm all for it as a playoff game.
Yeah.
Like the actual Rose Bowl, not playing UCLA.
You take what you can get,
right? The Mo Crum game, your Mo Crum.
Yeah,
game.
I remember it fondly. I just, you know, I'd like to upgrade to the actual Rose Bowl next time.
Yeah, that would be where I'd like to. I'm interested in that because my season ending was let's go ahead and qualify for the Fiesta Bowl and stay at the Camelback Inn again. It seems fine to me. But I've seen two games there, but it's my favorite place to go watch a game on the road is Knoxville. I want to go back to Knoxville and cover a game there. I like ending the season in Manhattan Beach, like Pete likes ending the season in Half Moon Bay for the Stanford game. Back to Arizona State would be just fine with me. If we can't go to Camelback Inn, I'll go to Arizona State in November. And I was considering Washington as well, but I think I'd like to go to Outson Stadium, Oregon, to see a game there. That might not help the playoff push if it's a night game against Oregon, maybe for Notre Dame early in the season. And I want to go to the Grove in Oxford. Ole Miss. I think that would be a lot of fun in the fans would be into that game going against Notre Dame. And of course, guys, Shamrock Series game every year, Navy in San Diego. We're also going to do this. One. I think we'll save the hoops question for Priester, who will join us again next week. It's Marcus Burton themed with some of the best freshmen we've ever seen. NFL Combine, though, we didn't get to that in the first segment, is starting today-ish. And this one's from Karsten 44 with the NFL Combine upon us. Who are some Notre Dame players that surprised you most with their transition from college to the NFL, positively or negatively? Who exceeded your expectations at the NFL level and who did not live up to those expectations?
For me, just because I have much less depth of knowledge than you two, I'll just briefly go first with a couple of more recent ones, and that would be Alohi Gilman and Drew Tranquil. Those guys were very nice college players. I did not see them carving out the sustained roles that they're showing in the NFL now. They're both second contract guys and beyond. I think that's impressive. So for me, those are those are just a couple of ones right off the top of my head that I feel like I can speak a little bit to. And then I knew Harrison Smith would be good. I'd seen him in high school. I'd done some high school TV stuff with him down in Knoxville. I couldn't have anticipated this sort of elite longevity for him to where he's very clearly on a path to Canton.
I would say, although I thought Drew Tranquil would basically have exactly the career he's having. He did not exceed or fail to meet expectations. Alohi Gilman, though, I think exceeded, though, because I don't think he's such a mentality player at Notre Dame. I'm not sure if like the physical traits were going to carry over. They have Brock Wright would be high on my list of guys have exceeded expectations going to the next level. And then, you know, one who I don't think is a league right now, but Isaac Rochelle for sure.
Right. Oh, I would throw in two more. I thought Kyren Williams would carve a nice role at the NFL level. I didn't expect him to be the NFL leading rusher, leading touchdown producer, or anything like that. So that would be one immediately for me. And then right now, because I think he did show some things at the combine and on pro day, Chase Claypool has been disappointing because he can't sustain it or put it all together. The guy has unreal talent, and he was so fun to watch his last year at Notre Dame when he took over some games, especially like that Virginia Tech game when he was just so wholly unstoppable. And then he had a great, promising rookie season at Pittsburgh, and it's dwindled from there. So, you know, I've only been around for a few years, but those stick out to me.
I think that's why Claypool should be included, is because he was great in his rookie season. Like, if that never happened, you would just see the normal flame out of a lot of college players, but he obviously showed he can play at that level. Kyren Williams is a great call, because I was hammering the desk saying Kyren Williams should be drafted. He is an ultimate number two running back, and he'll be in the league for two contracts, and he'll be excellent, and he'll have a couple 800-yard seasons, and now he's way better than that. So as much as I was a huge believer in Kyren Williams and didn't care about his 40 time at the combine, he's wildly exceeded my expectations. Believe it or not, I'm going way back. I did not think Bryan Young would be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Fantastic player coming out of Notre Dame when he came to the 49ers. He was one of the main reasons they won the Super Bowl that year, going right into the middle of the defensive line for the 49ers as a rookie. And then he only got better from there. Harrison Smith's a great point. We all thought Harrison Smith would be good, but I didn't know he'd be going to Canton. It's kind of like Zach Martin. We were laughing. I'm sure Pete, Tim, and I were like, why are you not taking Zach Martin? We didn't mean, well, he's going to be first team All-Pro seven times. We meant he could come start for your football team. So those guys exceed expectations. I, as a kid, thought Chris Zorich should be the most dominant force ever and just ignored the size thing. So he would be lead balloon guy I thought would be better in the NFL. I mean, he carved out a fine career, but I thought he'd be an absolutely great player.
Yeah, right. Julian Okwara would be more of like a situational success story than he's turned out to be. You know, Jerry Tillery, it didn't happen for him at the next level. I thought, you know, was Will Fuller, was he as good as what we thought based on college? Probably not. You know, and then just because I thought he was a fun guy to interview and just a engaging personality, I thought Troy Nicholas maybe would catch on more than he did at the next level. So those would be guys that surprised me a little bit. And I would throw Matthias Farley in there too, of like, I was like, you got to be kidding me that this guy's going to have a 6-7-8 year pro career. You know,
when he started not
starting in college, but he was just a hell of a utility and valuable player in the locker room.
We could probably get this one quickly. You guys have a list below. Jim Booney, CRS. If you could pick one player ranked outside the top 30 for Irish Illustrated at the end of the season and insert him into the top five of your end season rankings this year, which player would you choose in hopes it gives the greatest impact for Indy to win playoff games? And Jim Booney, CRS, says Billy Schroth, who we ranked at 47 as the season ended.
I'd go with Eli Raritan. And that one was a pretty instant answer for me. I'll go back once again to visiting with Jason Garrett a couple of years ago before Eli had gotten hurt midway through the 22 campaign, and Garrett telling me that he thought Nine, he didn't know his name at the time, he's like, Nine was the best player on the practice field both times I've been here. He looked really good. That guy's an NFL tight end. If Eli Raritan shows that sort of potential that had Jason Garrett absolutely gushing about him, and Garrett's forgotten more football than I could ever know, then I think you suddenly have the position to take Notre Dame to a whole other strata on offense, because you feel really good about your two running backs. You've boosted your wide receiver core. You obviously believe you can build and win with Riley Leonard. You need that one game-breaking tight end, and Eli can be that guy. If Eli Raridan is a top five player for Notre Dame at the end of this season, I think Notre Dame's a playoff team.
I'm going to take somebody that's not on the list at all, but I'm assuming that Boubacar Traore was not in your top 30.
Nope, he was not.
If he finished in the top five, or I would throw Christian Gray in there. If either of those guys had top five like seasons, this defense is going to be a real pain in the ass to deal with. So I'll go with that. I think that they could. Eli Raridan would be fun to watch as a top five player. I think that if it's Gray or Traore in the top five, that Notre Dame probably went 12-0.
I'm going to cheat because we ranked him 40. And if Steve Angeli is a top five player this year, it means Notre Dame has a top five quarterback and Notre Dame is all set, because that guarantees what he will be, what Riley Leonard and Sam Hartman were supposed to be, which brings us to now Christian Gray would be my realistic call as well, because then you have two top five corners, which is the key to defense. Actually, Wash ND wants to know, in comparison to where ND was at the start of spring practice last year, is ND better, worse, or about the same at the position groups? So remember, got to go back, not what you know what happened, but back to about last year. Quarterback, and I think we have to include Buckner in that, because he was a, he kind of liked him as your backup quarterback too last year, just like people like Angeli.
Yeah, quarterback, you have to say worse, because we're trying to, again, remember how we felt at this time last year, how we felt about Hartman, how we felt about Buckner coming off being the bowl game MVP. I'd say quarterback felt better last year than it does right now.
I agree, but I just don't think it will be, but I totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Like, for now you have to, but with the benefit of hindsight, I like where they are entering. I loved what Angeli showed in the bowl game. People say, well, Oregon State was well, Angeli was playing behind a revamped offensive line, didn't have a bunch of other players, didn't have Audric Estime. They love what Riley Leonard can do with his legs and growing the accuracy in his arm. So I think they're maybe technically slightly lesser off at quarterback as spring camp opens, but I'm like you, I'm bullish. I'm buying the future. I'm buying futures in this quarterback position. Running back, they're obviously not as good off because they don't have Audric Estime, but it's not as significant of a drop as what I think people might view it on the outside. And Mel Kiper just yesterday was talking about Audric Estime is one of his top three backs available in this upcoming draft. So that gives you an idea. You can't lose a guy who's projected to be a top three player at his position to the NFL and think you're better off, but I don't think it's significant. Downfall. If Eli Raridan's healthy, what they've done in the recruiting, I think they're much, much better at the wide receiver position and tight end. And then I'll let you guys pick it up from the positional groupings from there.
Yeah. I mean, worse at running back goes.
They had Logan Diggs. Remember, they had Logan Diggs.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a different kind of room. Wide receiver, tight end, better. But it's kind of hard to think back like how we felt about Mitchell Evans last year at this time. Was not how we felt about him on like October 10th.
No, it was not.
So, and the receiver room is just better, like without, a whole lot of offensive line, a lot worse. A lot. And that's kind of the big concern for the season for me right now.
Yep. Yeah. And defensive line is better because they're older and we like the Viper options more with Traore. We were not crazy high on JJB going into last year. I don't think RJ Oben will finish as Notre Dame's fifth best player, like Priester and I rated JJB fifth or sixth. But I like RJ Oben just as much as I like JJB going into last year at this point, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
Linebacker's worse. That's not.
Definitely worse at O-line, especially on the edges, although, you feel some hope there. But yeah, again, much like the estimate argument I just had with Joe Alt, you're talking about a top two player at his position going into the draft. You can't lose a guy that I think is going to be a 10 to 12 year franchise type tackle in the NFL and expect your O-line to be better. I do think not only with what they brought in via the transfer portal, not only what they bring in with the young kid that we already discussed first segment on the defensive line as a flash growing with Traore, but then bringing back Riley Mills and Howard Cross is just two absolute grown-ass men to anchor the middle of your line, makes your defensive line much better. Linebacker, obviously, it's a little bit of a step back because you just lose so much production
right.
And so much versatility and value with Bertrand and Maris. But again, much like the running back position, you got prospects there that give you some hope, not suspects.
Yeah, I think change could be fun too, right, Pete and John? Like, it's time to have new linebackers at Notre Dame. It's great that Kaiser's there to help, but I mean, we've been watching it since the Florida State game in Tallahassee. It's it's time for that. Which is totally fine too.
Linebacker by the end of the year, it wouldn't surprise me if that was better. But right now,
there's no way.
Right now, no. And it's like, could they get better production out of the will position this year than last year? I would hope that they would. I don't think we're going to be able to see some of the things that Bertrand covered up during the season. Essentially the plays that don't happen because he just knew where to be or knew how to slide somebody into the position where they were supposed to be when they didn't know. That's going to be tough. DB better. I think it's not a question of better. It's like how much. Morrison, Watts again had.
Oh my gosh.
We were optimistic about him last year, but didn't think he was going to be the National Defensive Player of the Year. So Morrison, Watts, and we talked about, if Gray or Jaden Mickey have breakout seasons, it could be an elite secondary where I think the question would be more, this is the best secondary since when? I don't know. But we can give it a few months, but I think during the regular season, we'll have the conversation. This is the best Notre Dame secondary since what? And I don't know. I don't know what year we're going to go to.
Yeah. I tell you what, guys, we're going to give it a month because we had a question. This is the best secondary since when? And we're going to come back in this podcast and give that a month. We at least want to see them play a little bit in spring practice.
Yeah, I would say definitely feel better about the secondary right now as opposed to a year ago. Because even with having brought in Thomas Harper, you didn't know he was going to be as good as he was.
Right.
But now you feel like you have two bona fide dudes in Ben and Xavier, and then you got other guys that really excite you, like a Christmas Gray or Christian Gray. And then it's not on there, but I would say special teams, you feel better right now than you did a year ago. I think that in talking with people the last few weeks in my conversation with Pete Limbo, who's, I'm just going to plug, he's an awesome guy. Like if you hear him talk ball or anything, he's such a good dude. So when I talked to him about Mitch Jeter, and he had so many details that he recalled about Mitch from recruiting in high school all the way back at Memphis now to where Mitch is and to talking to people on campus in the last week to 10 days, they say his talent is really clear. They say that his accuracy is really clear, and they feel like, quote, he's going to help us. We're better because we got him.
I do want to touch on Glasses Ref's question, even though we started with it, because it's been all over our boards and it's pretty important, because when Pete said way, way worse, he was not wrong. It can't be better than it was at this point last year. It seems that one position group that could hold the team back this year is the offensive line. How concerned are you that only one full-time starter is returning with two others with minimal end of season experience?
I mean, concerned, because it's like John referenced the running back. It's like you lose Estime, you can't be better. You lose Alt, you can't be better. But at running back, there's Jajarian Price and Jeremiah Love. There's not an offensive tackle like those guys in terms of either production or experience. So the thing that is stuck in the back of my head is talking to sources and understanding how hard Notre Dame pushed to get a transfer at tackle this offseason.
Yes.
Because that is a tell that they feel like they have some concerns there. Doesn't mean they can't surprise and play well. And,
they have options. Yeah, they do have options.
Charles Jagasa could have a breakout season. Maybe Tosh Baker is an Asmar Bilal type. I don't know. But I think the staff itself, if you had them on this podcast and were like, all right, what's keeps you up at night? It would be the offensive line. That doesn't mean it can't develop and grow, and these are college players, but going into spring practice, I think, is a legitimate concern.
Yeah, and how quickly they develop and grow to me is the singular factor, as Pete drinks from a Taylor Swift cup. I'm calling you out on the podcast for sure on that one. I only know
because do I have a teenage daughter? Yes, I do.
But Emily has this cup, and I don't want John to see this one. So there's.
I thought Dan got that for you, but anyway. I would say that's my singular concern. That's the biggest concern. If Notre Dame's offensive line coalesces and comes along to the potential that we've seen out of those guys at times in practice and certainly in their recruiting, their recruitments and their recruiting rankings, then again, Notre Dame stays very well positioned to be one of the 12 playoff teams this year. If not, then you're going to talk about a very disappointing season for Notre Dame. I think that those are just facts. Those are just the keys to me that will drive ultimately the entire season.
I do want to end with a write-in basketball question because we're going to save the historical perspective for Priester's return next week. But this one from Texas Connection, if anybody gets that reference, you get extra bonus points. Give me your thoughts on Notre Dame's last 2.5 weeks versus its previous 2.5 months covering this basketball team.
Oh, it's I wrote it this week on the site. I've seen it in person. I've enjoyed watching this team and covering this team. I will say a couple of things of note is the status of J.R. Konecny. I don't expect him to play Saturday. I think there's concern there that he could be out 2 or 3 more games. What does that do to the momentum that this team has? They obviously had wet toilet paper, thin margin of error already and going down to the stretch of the season. But they're providing a foundation, I believe. They're getting better. They're like the offensive line that we keep talking about. We're seeing it in front of our eyes. They have absolutely bought in to Micah Shrewsbury. They've absolutely bought into one another. And the way they're closing season makes you think, to me, that they can have an opportunity a year from now to be a team on the bubble challenging for a tournament berth, particularly depending on what they do potentially in the transfer portal. That was one more quick thing I wanted to note about Notre Dame and its offensive line. There's still one more portal window coming open, I believe April 15th through the 29th or something like that. So there's still a chance. They didn't get the guys. There weren't as many, I don't think, that went into the portal in December at that coveted tackle position that they had options for. But there's still a chance that they could get a portal tackle at the end of April. Then I think we'll have a better idea on this offensive line.
Before Pete answers the basketball, I want to interject again. There is a portal window because it included Prince Kali, Tyler Buckner, Lorenzo Styles, and Logan Diggs last year for Notre Dame. The window does exist. It's not all I'm already blanked on his name from Rhode Island.
It's the Nick McCloud window.
Yes,
Antonio the Nick McCloud Carter. Window is good. It's not all Antonio Carter.
Not all Antonio Carter.
No, it's definitely not. Yeah, basketball, the Wake Forest game, I felt like they Virginia Tech, Georgia Tech, Louisville was not enough to be like, all right, they've got something here. In some ways, I felt like they were more impressive in Syracuse and Wake Forest than they were in those 3 straight wins. And just to plug my other podcast, The Independent, we're actually going to have Micah Shrewsbury on tomorrow. So that'll be interesting to sort of talk to him about this. But I think John's assessment is spot on here. They can be a bubble team next year. If what they've done over the last 2-3 weeks, one, if it carries out, you get Clemson this weekend, you know, get one more, one of the last 3 regular season games. I think Micah Shrewsbury can feel pretty good about the fact that, all right, got some of the foundation down, because that's what this season needed to be about.
This is how I feel about them now versus back then. And I think there's a reality involved here, too. I think for the first time they are playing well enough now that in the NIT, Notre Dame would make a run in the NIT and beat those other type of teams that are between 70 and 96 in college basketball. But they weren't good enough to get in the NIT the first 2.5 months. They're not going to be able to get in unless they make a run to the ACC championship game.
Yep.
That's how bad they were prior. In which case, you would just qualify. For them to win out, they would actually qualify for the NCAA tournament. That's how many games they have to win to qualify for the NIT tournament.
Yeah. It's automatic bid.
It's really shocking that watching them now, you think, oh, they could take Clemson. They could be Clemson at home. Why not? They don't have to lose a rematch against Virginia Tech. You know, they could be down 13 in North Carolina and cut it to 7 instead of losing by 26 like they would have a month and a half ago if they went down 13 in North Carolina. It's a totally different team. It's a lot more fun to watch, and it's amazing when the ball goes in how much more fun it can be.
I wish I'd had the stats here directly in front of me. I should have been more prepared. But the second half against Syracuse and the second half against Wake Forest will be teach tape for months to come for Micah Shrewsbury and company. To give up 43 in the first half at home to Wake and then to stymie them to 22 points and just 8 field goals across the entire second half. That's a really, really talented offensive team that has put up some gaudy numbers, scored well into the 80s and 90s a handful of times this year. Those second halves, I thought, were incredible performances by Notre Dame, again, that provide foundational moments and teach tape for many months to come. jumping back to football just really quickly, just one little housekeeping thing to tidy up here. Around a year ago at this time, Notre Dame hired Butler Benton away from Arkansas. He'd been Arkansas's GM. I think Butler Benton's going to and Notre Dame are going to part ways here in the coming days and just let him see some different things. I don't think if they'd lost Chad Bowden, I don't think you would have seen Butler Benton leaving. But if it was an either or, and I think maybe that was a bit the case, then Chad Bowden has been your guy, and Chad Bowden is who you're kind of building your off the field personnel stuff around. And Butler Benton and Marcus Freeman go way back; they're tight friends. It's not a fun situation for anybody, but I think that's sort of how things are moving for Notre Dame and Butler Benton.
Good stuff, JB. That is it for this edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. We'll be back next Friday because, as we said, Thursday, March 7th, there is access. We'll have all practice and Marcus Freeman. Should be a four-man crew. Until then, thanks for listening. Irish Illustrated Insider, Pete, John Bryce, FootballScoop.com, Pete Stamps of The Athletic. This is Tim O'Malley. See you next week.